this episode of the Fisheries Podcast, I talk with Chris Horton of the Congressional Sportsman Foundation to discuss his role in advocating policy to members of the House and Senate. Thank you for joining me. I am Nick Kramer, and this is the Fisheries Podcast, a weekly podcast that shares the stories of the amazing people and projects that make up fisheries science. If you haven't already, follow the podcast on Twitter at Fisheries Pod or on Facebook at facebook.com/fisheriespodcast. Our guest today is Chris Horton. Chris began his career as a reservoir research biologist with the Arkansas Game and Fish Commission after receiving his master's degree from the University of Arizona. Eventually, he worked his way up to become the state's black bass biologist. His interest in bass led him to become the conservation director of BASS, the largest angling organization in the world. In 2010, Chris joined the Congressional Sportsman's Foundation as the Midwestern State's director. In addition to working with two regional coordinators in the 15-state Midwestern region, Chris also serves as the Fisheries Program Director for the Congressional Sportsman's Foundation and is the organization's primary point of contact on both state and federal fisheries-related issues. He currently holds a seat on the Marine Protected Area Federal Advisory Committee, American Sport Fishing Association's Government Affairs Committee, and the Center for Coastal Conservation's Government Relations Committee. Welcome to the podcast, Chris.
Thank you, Nick. I really appreciate the opportunity, and thanks for having me.
Well, Chris, I originally reached out to you because I thought it'd be nice to have a special themed episode right before Election Day. And the reason I reached out was you're a member of the Congressional Sportsman's Foundation. What does this organization do?
Sure. The Congressional Sportsman's Foundation was actually started in 1989 by members of the Congressional Sportsman's Caucus. Members on the Hill in both the House and the Senate, Democrats and Republicans in the late 80s said, you know, there's caucuses for everything else in Washington. Why don't we start a Sportsman's Caucus? So they did. That caucus quickly grew to be the largest caucus on the Hill with almost 300 members. And that model had worked so well that 2004, it went to the state legislatures to see if any of them would be interested in starting the same model within the state capitol so that you had a state legislative sportsman's caucus within the state legislature. There were a few states that already had something similar, sort of organization of a sportsman's caucus in the state capitol. Texas, Minnesota come to mind. But for the most part, it was kind of a new concept. But in 2004, we launched the National Assembly of Sportsman's Caucuses, kind of the umbrella organization to start these state legislative sportsman's caucuses, and that year there was 21 that were organized under the National Assembly Sportsman's Caucuses. Today we have 48 state legislative sportsman's caucuses. Not to be left out, in 2009, Governor Haley Barbour, then governor of Mississippi, said, well, I want to start a governor sportsman's caucus. So he worked with us and we established a governor sportsman's caucus with 9 members. Today we have 35 governors that are members of the governor sportsman's caucus. We at the Congressional Sportsman's Foundation basically provide serve as a resource for these caucuses, both the federal, state, and the governor's sportsman's caucus. The primary goal, these caucuses aren't meant to be voting blocks necessarily, but they're meant to be kind of a platform where we can engage the sportsman's community with their elected officials so that when they are making policy decisions, they fully understand what it means to the sportsman's community, what it means to the businesses that are associated with hunting and fishing in this country. For the state legislative sportsman's caucuses, we try to hold events throughout the legislative session, whether it be a lunch or a breakfast briefing covering some important policy topic going on within that state to allow members of the sportsman's community to get together with legislators and to discuss the issues. But really, I mean, anything in politics, like anything else, it's about relationships. And these caucuses provide the opportunity for the sportsman's community to get together with legislators that have the same values, the same passions and pastimes that they do, and develop relationships with these policymakers.
It sounds like most of these were politicians who are also sportsmen that form these caucuses. So is it very difficult to get in a room with them and talk to them about some of the issues?
Not at all. Generally, it's fairly easy because they already share the same kind of passions that we do from the angling community. And it's an opportunity to, again, develop these relationships so that when something does come up in the legislature or there's some need identified, whether it be with the state agency, whether it be a license fee increase or something like that, that, you know, anglers can go meet with these caucus members and let them know that, hey, this is something that we support. We support our agency. We support providing funding, additional funding, or securing additional license fees. We're willing to pay more in order to make sure that we have enough funding there to continue to effectively manage our fisheries.
So a lot of the public assumes that state agencies are funded through taxes, and some of them are, but most knowledgeable sportsmen understand that they are funded through licenses and fees. A lot of state agencies also get some help through special federal grants. Would you mind talking about some of those that affect the fisheries world?
Sure. You know, back at the turn of the 1900s, we had pretty much exploited our natural resources that we thought were almost inexhaustible to a point that we were realizing, you know, they're exhaustible, and our habitat was in terrible shape. And about that time is when a lot of state fish and wildlife agencies were forming around the country and issuing license fees to help cover the cost of habitat restoration and fish and wildlife management, but realized that those license fees alone were not going to be enough to overcome the habitat loss and the need for some significant funding for fish and wildlife restoration. So in 1937, Congress passed the Pittman-Robertson Act, which is the Wildlife Restoration Fund. And basically what this did was just diverted an 11% excise tax on firearms and ammunition to a separate account in the Treasury that the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service administered back to the states. But again, that was just the hunting and wildlife side. But that program worked so well that by the late 1940s, the sport fishing community came together and said, hey, tax us. We want to have the same type of program, the same type of funds coming back to our state fish and wildlife agencies to manage for better fish habitat and better fisheries. So in 1950, the Dingell-Johnson Act was passed, which put a 10% excise tax on fishing tackle, rods, reels, line, hooks, sinkers. And that program, again, worked very well. And then in 1984, they expanded that fund through what was called the Wallet-Breaux Amendment to the Sport Fish Restoration. And that actually increased the items that are taxable, like electric trolling motors, and also added marine fuel tax. So there's some way that the IRS can calculate how many gallons of gas are burned for motorboat fuels. And that goes back into the pot now as well. So looking at just some numbers from 2018, the apportionments that went back to the state through just this excise tax, through the Dingell-Johnson and Wallet-Breaux Acts, it was around $351 million that went back to the state in 2018.
And these funds are kind of distributed based off of the proportion of license sales coming from each state, aren't they?
Yes, they're based on a formula that is derived from license sales as well as land area. So you have number of license buyers as well as the size of the state, where it's coming back to. If you go back since 1952, when the first money from the 1950 passage of the Dingell-Johnson Act was passed, all the way through 2017, the amount of money that's gone back to the states for fish and wildlife management through this excise tax is a little over $8.8 billion. So it's significant. Anglers have truly been the backbone of conservation, fisheries conservation, for the last half century.
So is the Dingell-Johnson Act, is that the only program that is helping out the world of fisheries or other sportsmen?
The Dingell-Johnson Wallet-Breaux Act are the primary sources of funding coming from the federal government, specifically for state agencies to manage for fish habitat, fisheries management, boating access. But there are certainly some other programs out there. A lot of folks may not know that within the Farm Bill, there's a huge conservation title within the Farm Bill that's so important to managing for better fish and wildlife habitat, for managing for public access. One of the programs in the Farm Bill is called the Voluntary Public Access Habitat Incentive Program. In the 2014 Farm Bill, Congress authorized $40 million to go back to the states through a competitive grants program through the Natural Resource Conservation Service that helps states and tribes increase public access to private lands for wildlife-dependent recreation like hunting and fishing. These programs have been hugely successful in opening up a lot of new land and waters on private lands for hunters and anglers.
We use those funds here in Kansas for our fish program, where we lease out private fishing grounds for anglers, and we also have a walk-in hunting program that's wildly successful. And neighboring states, Oklahoma, just started a program recently, and they're just getting all sorts of property signed up in that. And Missouri and Iowa and Nebraska all have programs too, and I'm sure other states throughout the U.S. Those are just the ones close to me. But this is a really widely used program that maybe not a lot of people will know where the funding comes from. So thank you for explaining.
And we're hoping that the next version of the Farm Bill, which Congress is working on right now, as a matter of fact, both the House and Senate have passed their versions of the Farm Bill, which is now within a conference committee to work out the differences. And they're having some issues of finding some common ground, but primarily on some other provisions within the Farm Bill. Obviously, Farm Bill is a huge bill. It impacts every state in the nation, and it's always a bit contentious. But from the conservation title's perspective, there's definitely some differences between the House and Senate to work out. But the VPA and HIP program is identical in both versions and will again provide $40 million to the states over a five-year period for the VPA HIP program to sign up landowners and provide more access. Access is often cited in both the hunting and fishing communities as the number one reason that people stop participating, just lack of access to good fishing or lack of access to a place. So that's why this program is incredibly important that we continue to get it reauthorized in the next Farm Bill.
Yeah, oftentimes the most common question that an angler will ask when they first move or when they first get into the sport is, where can I go fishing? It's helpful to just hand them. In Kansas, we have a free fishing atlas that we can just hand them and say, here's all the state and federal and also our privately owned waters that we lease out that you can go and fish. So it's nice to have all these extra properties that you can point people to get them out in the outdoors hunting or fishing.
Absolutely. And I think you guys do a great job there in Kansas. Of doing that, providing that information for anybody, even somebody like myself from out of state who wants to come in and hunt or fish in the state of Kansas. And I've used that information a number of times myself.
So you mentioned another program in an email to me, the Reservoir Fish Habitat Partnership. Would you mind elaborating on that a little bit more?
The Reservoir Fish Habitat Partnership is actually one of 19 partnerships of the National Fish Habitat Partnership. And this program was actually started in about 2001, there was an ad hoc committee of the Sport Fish and Boating Partnership Council that recommended that we establish this fish habitat, this National Fish Habitat Partnership. It modeled somewhat off of NACA and the joint ventures that helped restore and turn around our duck populations. So that was kind of the same idea behind this whole National Fish Habitat Partnership, is to identify where our greatest habitat needs are, whether it's protecting good habitat or restoring degraded habitat, to improve stream, lake, reservoir quality, ultimately improve fishing opportunity. And since 2006 or 7, this program became somewhat official when the Secretary of Interior basically authorized it to move forward, and the Fish and Wildlife Service handles funding for the National Fish Habitat Partnership Program. But the whole idea of the partnerships has always been more of a local and state level, kind of a ground up type program, where local communities, angling organizations, state agencies work together to identify areas that they can improve habitat and improve fish populations. This partnership is made up of a national board that accepts applications for partnerships based on a specific need. And again, I said there's 19, and they range anywhere from species-based, like the Eastern Brook Trout Joint Venture, to system-based, like the Reservoir Fish Habitat Partnership, which was something I was heavily involved with initially to get organized, because you know, 70% of the fishing, recreational fishing effort in this country is on our lakes and reservoirs. So it's a whole range of partnerships, but identifying region-specific or national fisheries conservation needs. Unfortunately, this partnership has never been officially authorized by Congress. So the last three sessions of Congress, we've been working to officially have it authorized. There's about $7 million current funding that comes through the administration's budget each year, but we need to get it authorized. We're just looking to authorize it at the current funding level, but to have Congress officially recognize this partnership and set up board structure will allow it to go forward in a much more efficient way, and hopefully generate additional funding back to the states, back to these local partnerships to do more work. With the limited amount of dollars that they've had at this point, they've done some incredible work out there. In 2015, the partnership also completed the first comprehensive national assessment of our fisheries habitat need. The board uses that as kind of guidance on selecting the projects to do with the limited amount of funds each year. Currently, we have a bill in the House, H.R. 6660. Besides the ominous bill number, it's a good bill and would finally authorize the National Fish Habitat Partnership. There's also a companion bill in the Senate, S-1514, which was the Help for Wildlife Act that contained same provisions that are in the House were basically passed out of committee in the Senate in this bigger package of bills. We're hoping that as Congress comes back in after the elections during the lame duck, we will be able to get this bipartisan piece of legislation passed. Previous sessions of Congress, there's been a bit of an issue with some concerns from especially some Western legislators surrounding private property rights, water rights, stuff like that. But we've been able to work through those issues with those members, and this bill should be non-controversial. So we're hoping to either pass it in this lame duck or be ready to pass it early in the next Congress.
So you just mentioned the status of that one being hoping to get passed this year, and the Farm Bill VPA HIP programs also hoping to get passed sometime in the near future or approved. Are any of these programs or grants or bills at risk of going away in the near future or in the not so distant future?
There are some programs within the Farm Bill that without a reauthorization, the spending authority of the federal government in order to provide funds for these programs is essentially suspended until the full reauthorization occurs. And there is still talk amongst the principals in both the principals of the bills in both the House and Senate. They're still communicating. They're still trying to work out their differences so that they can get a reauthorization passed before the end of the year. If they don't, there will likely just be an extension until the beginning of the next Congress. But the Farm Bill is so important to the nation from so many aspects, from the SNAP program to farmer subsidies to the conservation title and crop insurance. I mean, it's a bill that I suspect will get passed as soon as possible now that the 2014 Farm Bill has expired. Unfortunately, in this Congress, it's just hard to predict when that's going to happen, especially in an election year.
And are there any drafts out there right now for future programs or other grants that you haven't discussed yet that would be of interest to the angling community or sportsmen in general?
Well, it's an existing, we talked about it earlier, but the Daniel Johnson Wallet-Bro, the Wallet-Bro portion of that, Daniel Johnson was a permanent appropriation. The Wallet-Bro has to be reauthorized every 5 years, 4 or 5 years, and we're just now beginning discussions on the next reauthorization, which will need to happen, I believe, by the end of the next session of Congress. So within the next 2 years, we'll need to get that reauthorized. And, you know, it's a program that anglers and the fishing and boating industry went to Congress and worked hard to get passed in 84. There's an Angling and Boating Alliance that's kind of led by the Association of Fish and Wildlife Agencies that CSF, we're a member of, National Marine Manufacturers Association, Boat US, the State's Organization for Boating Access, American Sport Fishing Association, BASS, you know, that we all work cooperatively to make sure that we can reauthorize and continue that incredible funding for the states.
Well, Chris, I'm sure your job is quite frustrating at times and at other times pretty rewarding seeing some of the fruits of your labor come through. But do you ever wish that you're still shaking hands with professional anglers rather than politicians?
That's a great question. Yeah, I often stop and just look and try to rationalize, how did I get here? Because to be honest with you, I mean, I grew up hunting and fishing. I mean, some of my earliest memories were fishing with my grandmother. And when I got to college, there were a number of things I was looking at doing. But ultimately, I decided on my career as a fisheries biologist because I loved it. I loved interacting with anglers, and I wanted to give something back. And when I got on my first spring electrofishing sampling event with the state agency, I thought, man, there's nothing better in the world. There's no way I'll ever do anything different. And then, lo and behold, here I am working with politicians. But, you know, it's the reason I started a career as a fisheries biologist, because I wanted to give something back to the resources that I love. And even though I'm not squeezing fish anymore, and I'm not going to a lot of bass tournaments, taking care of fish, or even working on fish habitat on the ground in the mud anymore, working on the policy angle to make sure that those opportunities still exist for us to fish, those opportunities to provide funding for fish habitat conservation and improving our fisheries. That's an important component too. So I'm still confused as to how I got here sometimes, but I'm thankful that I am.
And when this episode gets released, it might be a little late for people to be asking their local politicians or candidates, but are there any questions that you would recommend that people ask their candidates or politicians about some of these programs or how they stand on some of these programs?
No, I don't know if necessarily from a question standpoint, but, you know, obviously we need folks to engage with their members. I mean, everybody has a voice. I mean, that's the great thing. Although our political systems become more partisan, and you know, it's kind of a reflection a little bit on our society nowadays of how divided we can be sometimes from rural and urban areas. But at the end of the day, I mean, it's still the greatest system in the world, and we all have a voice. And it's so important that people engage in what's important to them. You know, ask for make sure we have strong conservation titles in the Farm Bill. Make sure that the BPA HIP gets funded. We want to see the National Fish Habitat Partnership fully funded in future years and to be authorized by Congress so that we can have better fishing in our own backyards. Everybody has a voice, and it's important to engage.
Is there a way to see who the members of these caucuses are, if it's some of your local politicians or not?
As far as the federal caucus goes, on our website at congressionalsportsmen.org, we have state profiles, and you can click on individual states, your state, and see all the members of Congress that are on there, or that are members of the caucus are listed on there, the governor's there, and the leadership of your state legislative sportsman's caucus is on there as well. It's very difficult to keep all the states updated because there's so much turnover, and there are over 2,000 state legislators that are members of their state legislative sportsman's caucus. So with the turnover, we can't list them all the time, but certainly from the congressional component, we have the members of Congress that are members of the Congressional Sportsman's Caucus, and then we have the State Sportsman's Caucus co-chairs or vice chairs listed on that state as well.
Well, the tough part of the interview is over, and we are down to the final five questions. And this is a group of five questions I ask each of the guests that come on the show, and we always start real simple. What is your favorite fish?
That's difficult to answer because in recent years I've gotten into saltwater fishing, and I love both inshore, offshore. I love chasing everything, trying to figure them out. But honestly, if I had to still pick my favorite fish, it would probably be a smallmouth bass. And that's just because fishing, growing up in South Central Arkansas, we catch mostly warm water species. But in the summer times, my favorite thing to do is to wade the mountain streams and rivers and to catch smallmouth. And to this day, smallmouth still excites me as much as 60 or 70 pound sailfish. You know, it's just love those little footballs. They fight so hard and they're beautiful. And really I've seen in some of our streams kind of a change in the stream itself where some of them are shallowing up, getting more shallow because of sedimentation. And obviously that changes the temperature dynamics and allows the water to warm a little bit better. So we're seeing in some areas anyway, more smallmouth more largemouth and spotted bass moving in, and so smallmouth they've always been close to my heart, and I still love to chase them when I can.
When I was in school, I got hooked on fishing smallmouth in the river and stream that ran right through campus of Iowa State, and after moving away from Southern Missouri, I kind of kicked myself for not traveling to some of those Ozark streams a little more often to smallmouth fish.
Absolutely. I mean, Crooked Creek, North Arkansas, the Buffalo River is still probably my favorite river in the world to fish for smallmouth. Number one, it's gorgeous scenery, but the numbers are on the upper end. The size it gets better as you go down, as you would expect. But yeah, we've got some real smallmouth gems in the Ozarks as well as the Washitas.
What is your favorite memory from your career thus far?
Wow, that's a good one. You would have to ask somebody that's older in his career to be able to pick one moment out, but I've had a lot of memorable moments from netting what I'm pretty sure or trying to net during a walleye spawning project, a walleye that I know was over the state record of 22 pounds at the time and closer to 25 pounds. I'll never forget that image of her sinking as I was trying to get two dip nets around her. But one of my favorite moments was just I was recognized by the Professional Anglers Association years ago. Tim Horton, a pro angler on the bass circuit, presented the plaque to me. But it was at that point that I realized, you know, what I was doing here was really truly making a difference out there. And that what we were trying to accomplish at Bass on behalf of anglers was important. And the work we were doing was important. So I would probably, if I had to pick one that stood out, that was probably it.
From some of your answers, I think I might already know the answer to this next one, but what is your dream job or dream location? Perhaps you're already in it.
Yes, sir. I would have to say that where I'm at currently, the Congressional Sportsman's Foundation affords me the flexibility to work from home in Arkansas, although I do continue to travel a lot. But at the end of the day, I wanted to do something that I could give back to the natural resources that in our hunting and fishing traditions that I care so much about, and that so many other Americans care so much about. And the Congressional Sportsman's Foundation certainly affords me that opportunity. So I would have to say I'm living my dream job right now.
And then, if money was not an issue, what is one project that you would like to work on or see completed?
Honestly, I would love to see the National Fish Habitat Partnership become authorized by Congress and that program be able to truly address, with whatever funding they need, all of the fish habitat needs across the country and improve fishing. If I had to pick one specific project, that's a little bit too broad. If I had to pick one specific project, honestly, I think that would have to be Everglades restoration. I lived in Florida for a number of years working for BASS, and I've had the chance to fish in the Everglades today, but I can't imagine what the Everglades would have been like 100 years ago before we channelized the Kissimmee River, before we built the levee around Lake Okeechobee, as well as in the estuaries on either Florida's coast that are often impacted by the nutrient loading that comes down the Kissimmee, collects in Lake Okeechobee, and then when the water's level gets high to where it's threatening the integrity of the dike, they have to flush it east and west, and then we have significant impacts in saltwater fish in the estuaries. But I would have to say restoring that flow southward would make a tremendous difference as far as the ecology of southern Florida, and some of the best fishing in the world would just get a whole lot better.
And then finally, if there was one point or principle that you could have programmed in everyone's head, what would it be?
One point or principle is for folks to forget that they have a voice and they can make a difference in natural resource policy. That they have an opportunity to get engaged with their politicians and they have the responsibility to get engaged. If we want to continue having the opportunity to hunt and fish, and the opportunity to have abundant fish and wildlife resources into the future, we should all get engaged.
All right, Chris, thank you for coming on the podcast today. It was a pleasure learning about you and the work you are doing with the Congressional Sportsman Foundation. If people want to find out more about you or your organization, how would they do that?
Again, you would go to the congressionalsportsmen.org website. That's congressionalsportsmen.org.
And if you would like to get a hold of me, you can find me on Twitter at FisheriesPod, on Facebook at facebook.com/fisheriespodcast, or old-fashioned email at feedback@thefisheriespodcast.com. I hope that you enjoyed this episode. Tune in next week when I will interview Josh Flowers, who is a private lakes biologist in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. Don't forget that you can download and subscribe on your favorite listening app or stream it from Spotify or thefisheriespodcast.com. I am Nick Kramer, and thank you for listening to the 11th episode of the Fisheries Podcast. And remember, everyone has a voice and an opportunity to get engaged to enhance the opportunities for every sportsman.